All right. Back at it for another round. I'm gonna finish up at the Ottoman Empire and see how they ended up struggling and ultimately crumbled as a result of European incursions. And then we'll spin the globe and then we'll go to the Asian region. All right, so we know in the 19th century, Europeans, motivated by profit, started basically launching what was known as the Age of New Imperialism. And they were motivated for resources because of the Industrial Revolution, and they justified their actions based on new ideas that appeared in the 19th century. Social Darwinism, 19th century racism. And ultimately, they believed that they were superior. And what gave them the right to think that? Well, they were winning the wars. And if you win the wars, that means you're better than the opponents. So, for example, I'm not one of those people that sit back and worry too much about what happened to the Indians or the Native Americans, because ultimately they lost. Just like I don't worry about what happened to the ancient Romans. They lost. So ultimately, the social Darwinists, you know, were kind of right in their position. But of course, that impacted the civilizations in which they came in contact with. So like the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire, as we know, was once great, it was once powerful, but as a result of a whole bunch of factors, the Europeans began pushing back and they started crumbling. Mehmed comes in, destroys the forces within the empire that was standing in the way of reform and would try to save his empire. He got rid of the Janissaries. He put the Ulama, the religious priests, in their place and ultimately asserted his position on the throne by building a modern army. And then once he got rid of the barriers, he implemented a series of reforms known as the Tanzimat Fermani, which is Turkish for reorganization decree. He essentially reorged his empire. In an edict, the Sultan told his people straightforward why he was doing it, in which it says in part, and I quote, "to bring the benefits of good administration to the provinces of the Ottoman Empire through new institutions." He wanted to get rid of the old and bring in new for the good of the people. But he followed a template. He didn't just go at it willy-nilly. No. He essentially would pursue these reforms based on what the Europeans were doing. Because again, he wasn't dumb. He knew the Europeans were winning. And any of you want to emulate the losers? I don't know anyone in their right mind who would want to. So what does this mean? Simple. We're talking about constitutions, rules of law, modern standards. Now, luckily, the father came up with the idea, and his sons, his immediate two successors, Abdul Jamed I and Abdulaziz, would do everything in their power to implement these reforms in order to ensure that they were successful. And one last point, the irony is by putting in a new government system, it also triggered a social revolution that impacted the lives of the ordinary people. Change occurred. Bless you. Questions so far? Now, I don't have time to talk about everything he did. There's just not enough time to do it. But let's just say he took what was there and he scrapped it and he replaced it with something that was new. So, for instance, he got rid of the old laws and wrote whole new codes of law, both criminal laws and civil laws. Of course, criminal being the things that you go to jail for, and civil being the things that you can be sued over. Well, the reformers looked at the law codes of England and France and Germany and the United States, and they brought in some of those ideas to try, like our country, where there's the rule of law, not of men. He also tried to engage internationally on a level playing field. For the first time in the Ottoman history, ambassadors, diplomats were sent out and exchanged. They opened Constantinople and allowed European diplomats and ambassadors to come in. They engaged in discussions. The Ottomans attended international conferences. They tried working in harmony with the West, not in opposition. Society was changed. From clothing, they got rid of the old turbans and, you know, the sheikly robes, and men started wearing Western-style clothing. Suits, ties, pants, jackets. They brought in professors from Europe, created a new university system. They brought in European sciences, physics, mathematics, engineering. They redefined citizenship. Previously, under the Ottoman Empire, the only way you could have full rights is if you were a Turkish Muslim. That was replaced by a new series of laws that allowed every legally born person, man, I should say men, not women, but men in the empire, regardless of race or religion, were considered citizens. And they all had equal rights, including the right to own property. A decade before slavery ended in the United States, the Ottoman Empire got rid of slavery. They also got out of the slave trade. And they abolished the devshirm. Little Christian and Jewish boys weren't taken from their homes and forced to convert to Islam. That was abolished. The old traditional way of the sipahis, the Turkish nobles and the janissaries, that was all scrapped. And instead, they implemented an army based upon universal conscription. Men of all the different ethnicities, men of all the different religions could be drafted and serve side by side in the army. The men wore uniforms, they trained, they drilled. No more swords and spears and bows and arrows. They were armed with guns. Modern military officers. Terms of service were also implemented. All men that were conscripted, drafted into the army, served 2 years. They not only revamped the military, they implemented a postal system. For the first time since the days of ancient Persia, it was possible to send a letter anywhere within the empire and beyond. They built railroads. They built telegraphs. They just went to town. And finally, they would implement a new constitution. Constitution was based on the European models, not ours. So the Sultan would still be like a constitutional monarch. He could declare war, he could appoint ministers. He was the chief executive. But the vizier became more like the prime minister or the chancellor. And there would be a parliament that would pass the laws, and the members would be elected. There was separation of powers, checks and balances, due process of law was guaranteed. I already said right to property. Free press was allowed. All religions were tolerated. Now, granted, the official religion was still Islam, but all religions would be tolerated, and all groups, including minorities, would receive civil protections. They literally took the Ottoman system, the Ottoman society, and flipped it on its head. Over the course of 35 years, change after change after change started having significant impact in change. The Ottoman Empire was moving closer to be like the European countries. But the Tanzimat reforms didn't help everybody. Nope. Artisans, people who made things by hand, they were hurt. Because one of the things that the new government did was make trade agreements with the European countries. So manufactured goods began flooding into the country, putting many people that used to do things by hands out of business. And women got nothing. Women got nothing. I think I still have that up there. Yep. Sharia law, religious law of Islam, still governed women's place in society. They had to stay in the house. They were not allowed to go outside unless accompanied by a male. They still had to wear burqas. They had to be covered head to toe. Not even allowed to show a little wrist. And men, of course, were still allowed to have multiple wives. No divorce. A husband could still beat his wife. And if there was an instance of adultery, a man would be forgiven, but a woman, she could be stoned. And they still do that in parts of the Islamic world today. They'll gang rape a woman and then tie her down on the ground and pummel her with rocks until she dies. So life was good for the men. Life was good for the different religious groups, the ethnic minorities. But there was still definitely gender disparity. Ironically, all of these changes helped the empire overall, but it weakened the position of the sultanate. The Sultan went from being an all-powerful emperor, who was a combination of an emperor and a pope, to a king like Charles III, a figurehead. And there were many conservatives that didn't like that. So there would be a challenge. Question. Now, just at the point that all of these reforms are being finalized, there would be a coup within the palace. A group of conservatives who were opposed to the Tanzimat reforms appeared. And they would launch a coup d'etat against Abdulaziz, the second son of Mahmud. he would be pulled off the throne and he would be replaced by Murad V. The conservatives hope that with Murad on the throne, he would veto all of the changes. In other words, no more rights for different religious groups. No more toleration. Wanted the Turkish Muslims to maintain a position of dominance. But, much to the chagrin of the conservatives, once they put him on the throne, he said he would go forward with the will of the people. And the people seemed to like the Tanzimat reforms. So he pledged he would rule as a constitutional monarch. He would accept the new constitution. But unfortunately, he fell ill. He became incapacitated. And while he was incapacitated, when he was at his sickest, it allowed the conservatives to launch a second coup in the same year. And Murad would be deposed. He would be pulled off the throne. And then something bad would happen that would ultimately set the Ottoman Empire up for its ultimate fate and its destruction. Questions? The conservatives selected Abdul Hamid to come in and be the new sultan. He would be elevated to that position in 1878. He was a religious conservative. He viewed all of these changes as a threat to the Sultanate. The all-powerful Sultanate, which dated all the way back to Uthman in the 13th century. He was in the bloodline. He was a descendant. Going back to Uthman's dream, where Allah came down and told him to spread Islam and conquer the enemies of Islam. He sat back and said, well, I can't sit there and simply sign documents of legislation. I can't accomplish the whole reason for the Sultanate. So he comes in and with the help of his advisors in his cabinet, they begin suspending all of the Tanzimat changes and reestablished the absolute power of the Sultan, where he could make and enforce law. Constitution was ripped up, nullified. All of the civil rights that were given, removed, eliminated. If you opposed, you would be arrested, tortured, and sometimes killed. All of the European businessmen and the diplomats, they were all kicked out, except for the Germans. He liked the Germans. And by the way, as a result of that, the Germans would actually build the Berlin-Baghdad railroad line, which would be the only connection that the Ottoman had by land to the European continent. It was also the Germans who built all the telegraph lines. So he comes in and he starts imposing his will. He's squashing dissent. He's squashing the reformers. But unlike what had happened historically in the Ottoman Empire, where the people who were opposed to the Sultan were basically wiped out, a lot of them managed to escape because they had connections with the outside world. And many people went into exile. And these people outside of the Ottoman Empire began uniting, unifying, forming groups with the hope of coming back and launching a coup d'etat or a revolution. By the way, this is what the Bolshevists did. The Bolshevists, the group that overthrew the Tsar in Russia, they organized outside of Russia. They planned, they trained. And they only came back when the opportunity was right. Well, these dissidents had to, because if they tried doing any revolutionary work within the Ottoman Empire, they would be hunted down and shot or beheaded on sight. Now, out of all of the exiled groups, there was one group that organized in Paris that would be the most influential. And it would be a group technically called the Ottoman Society for Union and Progress. Although they were better known by their nickname, the Young Turks. Now, these college-age men, they outwardly professed loyalty to the regime. So they didn't necessarily organize to oppose Abdul Hamid. But rather, they wanted the reforms back. They wanted the constitution. They wanted the life that they were promised, that it was taken away from them. And what they did was use modern technology to gain support. They printed pamphlets. They give lectures. They went and met with European nobles and received donations. But as time went on, they became radicalized. Some of their members snuck back into the empire and engaged in assassinations or terrorism. But it was never large scale because the army stayed with the Sultan. So, like, the line that the Democrats use about the protests that took place on January 6th, that it was an insurrection. You know, that was not an insurrection. The people that were there angry protesting, they didn't have guns. You know, you kind of can't overthrow a government if you don't have guns. Well, the same was true back then. Yeah, they may have taken down one or two people. They may have blown up a couple of government offices. But they weren't going to topple the regime because the army would have been there to shoot them. But fast forward 20 years, and even the army got tired of Abdul Hamid II. In 1908, a revolution was launched. The revolution was spearheaded by the Young Turks. But this time, officers in the army joined with them. Officers who pledged their loyalty to the country, but not the man in power. Now, by the way, that's one of the reasons why our young men and women that go into the military, when they take their oath, they don't pledge an oath to the President of the United States. They pledge an oath to the Constitution, to serve and defend the Constitution of the United States. So if we ended up having a dictator-like president, the army, in theory, would work to remove the person. Well, the officers in the army by 1908 had gotten sick and tired of Abdul Hamid because his government became corrupt and abusive. And they loved their country. So they joined with the Young Turks and would effectively overthrow Abdul Hamid II. Now, to ensure that the next sultan could be controlled, they went out and found one of Abdul Hamid's cousins. Again, has to be in the same family. And they put him on the throne, Mahmud V. Mahmud essentially agreed to take the position, but promised not to get involved in politics. So effectively, he would remain the caliph, the spiritual head, but he would not attempt to rule like King Charles III. Questions? Bless you.
Thanks.
And what did these guys do? Well, the whole reason why they rebelled is they wanted the Constitution back. So they restored the Constitution of 1876. And they brought back all of the freedoms that were guaranteed, including freedom of the press. But unfortunately, the move towards liberty was short-lived because now you had a new group that was in power. And once they were in power, they were determined to keep it. Classic example, Samuel Adams, one of the leading members of the Sons of Liberty. It was because of the actions of Samuel Adams and his followers that would ultimately result in many of the events that you learned about in U.S. history, like the Boston Tea Party, for example, the attacks during the Stamp Act, Lexington and Concord was because of Samuel Adams. Samuel Adams, prior to the War for Independence, was a revolutionary. But after the War of Independence occurred, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. And there were periods in early Massachusetts history where people were rising up against Boston because of the taxes. There was a big revolt in Uxbridge. There was another revolt that was out in Springfield. People were pissed off. And they used the same rhetoric of the Sons of Liberty. No taxation without representation. A movement that was started by Samuel Adams. But what did Samuel Adams do once he was governor? He called out the militia and would crush all of the uprisings. They were essentially doing the same thing he did. Well, the Young Turks would be the same. The moment they opened everything up, people started talking. People started calling for different ideas, different changes. And unfortunately, when the doors were open, all of the ideas that we had talked about, social Darwinism, 19th century racism, militarism, that all flooded into the Ottoman Empire. And these Young Turks sat back and were thinking of these ideas and saying, well, yeah, the Turks are definitely the superior race in the Middle East because the Turks should be able to win wars. And if we can win wars, then we can control the racial inferiors. So they started calling for the creation of a new order based on Turkish nationalism. They wanted to purge their empire of its diversity and instead impose homogeneity. They wanted to get rid of the Christians and the Jews and the different ethnic groups. The Assyrians, the Greeks, the Armenians, the Arabs. Get rid of all those and make everybody Turks. Make them speak Turkish and make them Muslim. And if they do that, they'd be strong like Germany or England. This became known as Islamic Turkish ultra-nationalism. Questions? Spearheading this movement, I'll go back. I know I'm going quick. I get excited about this stuff. I'm a dork. I'm sorry. Actually, truth be told, I thought I was at the bottom of this page, but it wasn't. Are we good? Three leaders who embraced this movement fully would emerge within the government in Constantinople and essentially would take full control over the empire. Because again, remember, Mehmed V is a puppet. Involved in this was Enver Pasha. Pasha being an honorary title, by the way. Kind of like Lord in England. Enver Pasha was the minister of war. He was the head of the war machine. The minister of war. There also was Mehmed Talat Pasha. Talat served as the Minister of Internal Affairs. The Minister of Internal Affairs. It's kind of like in our country, he would be like the Secretary of the Interior, plus maybe the head of the Department of Homeland Security. So Enver was easy. He's controlling the military. But Talat, he controlled all of the government land and all of the government security forces, including the police. And last, Ahmed Jamal Pasha. Jamal was the military governor of Constantinople. So he controlled the capital completely. Now all these three men had two big things in common. One, they were all Islamic Turkish ultra-nationalists. They wanted to eradicate religious and ethnic diversity and replace it with homogeneity, everyone being the same. But the other thing they had in common, they were all fans of Germany. So, thanks to these three men, the Ottoman Empire would form a secret alliance with Germany in 1914. And when World War I erupted, that's why the Ottoman Empire joined as one of the Central Powers. Because they wanted to be like the Germans. Imperial Germans, not the Nazis. That's World War II. So, October 1914, they're in World War I. Now, in World War I, as we're going to see, because we're going to talk about it, all of the countries were involved in this battle to the death. But all of the countries had military goals. There were territories that they wanted. The Ottoman Empire really didn't want anything. They only joined the war so that we could be with their friends, Germany. But what they did during the war was horrific. Because while all of the world was busy killing each other on the Western Front, in the trenches, or on the Eastern Front, everyone was paying attention to the war that was going on. The ultra-nationalists, the triumvirate, sat back and said, yeah, let's see if we can implement some homogeneity by eliminating some of our diversity. See, they wanted to create what they referred to as a new order. They justified their decision by claiming that all of the military losses that the Ottomans had suffered going back to the Siege of Vienna in 1683 were not because of the Turks. No, it was because of all of the minorities that were fighting in their armies, particularly the Christians. So, the only way that the empire can be strong is to eliminate them. The first step in the elimination came when Mehmed, a puppet, at the behest of Enver, Talat, and Jamal, would declare jihad on the infidels. Anyone within the borders of the empire who was not a Turkish Muslim had a target painted on the back. But these three were careful. While the majority of their population was Turkish, the second largest were Arab Muslims. So they didn't want to mess with the Arabs. So instead, they focused on small little ethnic groups that they felt that they could erase and no one would notice. Such as the Assyrians, the Greeks, and of course the Armenians. All ancient ethnic groups that had been living in that part of the world for thousands of years. But they all had one thing in common. They were all not Muslim. So they literally would use the fog of war. Everyone paying attention to what was going on. And they would purge the empire of these racial groups. Now, I know genocide is boring, but imagine a group of soldiers showing up in your village, taking all of the men older than six, just outside of the central part of town, and shooting them. And then you take all of the kids under six, male and female, along with all the women, and you march them hundreds of miles to the Arabian deserts. All along the way, they are assaulted, they are robbed, they are sexually abused. Countless stories of women throwing their babies into the rivers or off cliffs. Better to have them dead than suffer. And then, while the world is paying attention to what's going on in Europe or in Russia, these people are marched out into the desert and left to die. This genocide, the intentional desire to kill groups because of their race, was the first genocide of the 20th century. 1.2 million Armenians, 500,000 Assyrians, 200,000 Greeks, all killed by their own government in the name of racial and religious harmony. All of their property confiscated by the state. The houses were taken. The churches were burned. Cemeteries were dug up. And they effectively would attempt to eradicate the existence of these people who had lived on the land for thousands of years. Why? Because they weren't the right race and religion. Now, FYI, in Mein Kampf, Hitler references this. And he acknowledges if you're going to wipe out a group of people, the best time to do it is during war, because no one's paying attention. Now, to this day, the Turkish government does not acknowledge that this genocide occurred. But I grew up in Northbridge, Whitensville. And in my town, I don't know if it's still the case because I moved out 30 years ago. But when I was a kid, there was a very large, sizable Armenian population there. And I had the blessings to talk to one of my buddy's grandmothers who actually survived this. So it's kind of near and dear to me. But it's real. This is what happens when you believe that you are the master race. The rest are disposable. Questions? Now, besides killing off nearly 2 million of their own people, in the end, the Ottoman Empire should not have joined World War I. It didn't have the military. It didn't have the economy. And in the end, the empire would get essentially knocked out of the war. In September 1918, the Ottoman Empire surrendered. Now, FYI, the irony is one of the things that caused the empire to crumble was thanks to a guy by the name of Lawrence of Arabia. He was a British spy that infiltrated the Arabian Peninsula and convinced the Arabs to rise up against the Turks. Because as Lawrence of Arabia basically told the Arabs, hey, look, they're killing the Christians, but they've said in their propaganda they're going to do the same thing with racial groups. So the Arabs joined with the British and would topple the empire from within. In 1919, seeing the writing on the wall, however, a man by the name of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk would lead a nationalist movement and would basically rip Turkey out of the Ottoman Empire. It would be Atatürk that would give birth to the modern state of Turkey, the Republic of Turkey. The empire was dissolved. All of the lands were taken by the British and the French. And empire dissolved. All that was left was taken over. The House of Saud would get Saudi Arabia. And they would create these artificial countries based on drawing lines on a map. But it marks the end of a 600-year ruling dynasty that in the end would shoot themselves in the foot. Questions? Of course, the funniest thing is that this empire was brought down by its own ideas. Ideas that it borrowed from the Europeans. So it didn't just take physical invasion to bring down the remnants of the past. The Europeans were effective even with their brains. Although they didn't do it intentionally. No questions? I can see at least one person's taking notes. Where are you at, David?
I can't really see it because of the picture. But...
Empire dissolved? Or Mustafa Kemal?
Oh. I need the other two lines, but I couldn't see it.
Oh, that says dissolved. Go to that one. And then 600-year dynasty. See how there's only like three of you actually that actually take notes the old-fashioned way. If did that ever happen, just let me know. I'll stop. All right, so we've conquered and carved up Africa. We've toppled the Ottoman Empire. And now let's see what they did in Asia and the Pacific. First and foremost, the big winner was England. By the early part of the 18th century, we already talked about how they went in there province by province and put British Rajas on the throne, and the Rajas would basically make economic deals with the British. But by the 1820s, 1830s, they had secured all of modern India, Pakistan. That's Pakistan, actually. What am I talking about? Burma and into Southeast Asia. Ironically, they used India as a launching point for other operations. Many of the colonies that would be taken in Africa were actually taken by the British, not with British soldiers, but by sepoys. Indians that volunteered to serve in the British Army. And I'm doing World War I in one of my other classes. There are a couple of slides on there where I have pictures of guys from India in the trenches in Western Europe. I only mention that because the Brits would use that force to continue their expansion in Asia. But it wasn't just the British that were putting pressure on the Asians. The French were there. The Dutch were there. Of course, by this point, the Dutch managed to seize control of almost all of Indonesia. The French had pushed into Vietnam and made that ancient kingdom a colony. But if you notice, what they're doing is slowly moving towards the real goal. China. Because China was the heart of the Asian trade network. I think it was 1973? Might have been 72. President Richard Nixon flew to China and met with Mao Zedong and would effectively make a trade agreement that would open up China. Of course, ironically, as a consequence of that, that's the reason why everything you can get in Walmart is that cheap crap made in China by slave labor, including your iPhones. But the reason why Nixon went to China in the first place is he put it this way. Imagine if every person in China, by the way, China today has one out of every five human beings on Earth are Chinese, although the Indians are going to surpass them, I think, in the next decade, because the China implemented one child policy. But anyways, imagine taking one out of every five people on Earth and selling them a pack of cigarettes, McDonald's hamburgers, or a General Motors automobile. Well, that wasn't a new idea thought of by Nixon. That was an idea thought of by the Europeans going back to the time of the Portuguese when they first got into the Asian trade network. If they could get into China and take control of its economy, the nation that had more people on Earth living within its borders, think of the profit margins. Ultimately, it would be the Brits that would make the first charge because the Brits had control of the second largest economic zone in Asia, India. And by the 1820s, in 1830s, the timing was right because the Manchus, the Qing dynasty, was going through the dynastic circle. They were already past 6 o'clock. They were suffering from incompetency, corruption. The economy was going downwards. They weren't maintaining infrastructure. And natural disasters were occurring. So China sat back and was slowly dying just at the point where the British wanted to kick in the doors. Now sadly, the Chinese believed, because the Chinese had the long view of history, that if they ignored the British, they would go away. Or they would come begging for favors. The biggest mistake that the Qing made? Was this. What would you do for 20 bucks? Money is a powerful motivator. What would you do to get it? So the Qing were sitting back using Confucianary traditions that had been in place for 2,500 years. They didn't understand the economic aggression that the Europeans were willing to use to get profit. And ultimately, that's the biggest reason why they would fall. Just like what happened to the Ottoman Empire. Just like what was happening in Africa. Now, you should have this in your notes. We did talk about it. Unlike other countries, China did have a buffer. Going back to the Ming Dynasty, they had the Canton system. And for 200 years, the British played along with it. So under Chinese law, if a non-Chinese person was caught in mainland China, they would be killed on sight. But you were allowed to do business with China so long as you went to, well, Canton. So long as you pulled into the harbor, had your ship inspected, paid a fine, then you were allowed to trade with and get whatever goods the Chinese wanted to give you. course, we should remember what was the big commodity the Chinese wanted more than anything? Had sacred properties. Was not found in abundance in China, but it was found in abundance in South America.
Silver.
Silver. Yeah, very good. But the Brits decided giving the Chinese silver was stupid because silver was a standard of currency. So the Brits came up with an alternative. They sought to disrupt the favorable balance of trade that the Chinese maintained with drugs. Opium. Opium. Now, FYI, China's doing that to us today. Not only are they flooding our markets with cheap crap, they're also pumping in fentanyl. Fentanyl is finding its way into all of the drugs that young people use recreationally. And if you are paying attention to the news, tens of thousands of young people are dying from overdoses because of that secret ingredient. The Chinese are clever. They understand that human beings, particularly Americans nowadays, are soft and stupid. So, because they are soft and stupid, they don't have discipline. They'll use a highly addictive substance, get them hooked, and then they're customers. Just like TikTok. China does the same thing with TikTok. But back then, there was no technology. So the Brits decided to use opium, which was highly addictive. Now, by the way, China could produce opium, but the opium that was produced in India was way more potent and way more addictive. According to some of the readings on this, usually a user could use it twice before they became completely mentally and physically addicted to the substance. And then you're hooked. You're a customer. But the problem is, in China, the importation of opium was illegal. So in order for the Brits to get it in, it had to be smuggled in. And it was packaged in these little chests. How was it made? Well, the British used the Industrial Revolution process. They had local farmers in India that would harvest the poppy plants, and then they had processing centers where all of these Indian guys would get paychecks, and they would cure and treat and process and pack the opium, and it would be smuggled in on the cargo ships because they were tiny little chests. And by the way, the Chinese liked smoking it. And all in the inner cities were opium dens where you could go in and you could basically get stoned, like some of the drug-using centers that they opened up in Oregon. Well, in 1800, when they began, the Brits were able to smuggle in about 5,000 chests per year, which was about 130 pounds of it. But you only need a little bit. But by 1935, they were smuggling in an excess of 40,000 chests. Roughly a ton or two. Why? Money. It's estimated in 1800, less than 0.1% was addicted to opium. But by 1850, 38, it's estimated that 1% of the population was addicted. 1% of the Chinese population at the time was 4 million people. So England's goal was to increase the numbers to 2%. Because it was good. It was a good. This was business. Now, ironically, the people who were buying the drugs weren't the poor people. Poor people can't afford drugs. No. The people who were buying the drugs were the wealthy, the nobles, the rich merchants. Particularly their kids. They would take money from mom and dad and go get their fix. And they would become hooked on drugs. Well, the irony is that from the arrival of the Portuguese up until the 19th century, silver was flowing inwards and China maintained a favorable balance of trade. But within just a decade's time, England managed to reverse it. And it was estimated in 1840, more silver was coming out of China than was going in. Questions? So what do? Your country is getting essentially raped by another country. What do you do about it? Well, the Qing would actually make an attempt to stop it. I mean, after all, they were the government. They had a legal right to do so. Now, during the last presidency of the last occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the Trump administration launched an all-out war on fentanyl. And it's estimated by the FBI that the importation of the smuggling of fentanyl began to decline because most of it was coming over the border. And of course, we know Trump would start building sections of the wall. And he would send border security down there and essentially would crack down on things. And people were getting arrested and prosecuted. Of course, the current occupant, he doesn't care. He ended all of the border restrictions. And there's hearings in Congress. Again, I think they estimated, like I said, I think last year alone, I think 60, 70,000 people died from fentanyl. Just 1 year, because it's coming in and it's just flowing in. Well, the Qing didn't want their people to be hooked on drugs, because if you're hooked on drugs, you're not working, you're not producing, you're not contributing to the well-being of society. So what do? The emperor sent orders to the governor of Canton, the man who oversaw the Canton system, and they gave him full authority to stop it by any means. Lin Zhu Xu. Lin was a scholar gentry. He went to the Imperial Academy, he took the Confucian exams, and he was regarded as being one of the most incorruptible government officials in all of China. He could not be tempted to deviate from his duty. Once he was empowered by the emperor, he went to work of getting opium out of Canton. And if you could get opium out of Canton, you're basically going to stop the flow coming in. How does he do it? Well, first, he tried negotiating with them. He would meet with the British merchants and try to ask them nicely, look, the emperor doesn't want the drugs coming in. Can you stop, please? To which the merchants would be like, yeah, no, we're not bringing any drugs, even though it's all tucked in other commodities. Lin Zhu Xu would actually send a letter to Queen Victoria, appealing to her morality as a Christian, saying essentially, you know, Christian charity, Christian support. There's nothing in the Bible that said Jesus wants you to use drugs to destroy a civilization. But unfortunately, the letter was never delivered because all of the British merchants didn't deliver it. So, when words didn't work, Lin Jushu would then take action. He used his full authority given to him by the emperor. He first blockaded all of the trading houses, the factories, and then sent soldiers in and began searching through the warehouses. Any merchants on site that were found in possession of opium were arrested. And in total, in just one sting, he confiscated over 20,000 chests, to which he dumped in the harbor and essentially destroyed the goods. Well, here's the thing. Under English common law, all citizens have a right given to them by God to possess property. And no force can interfere with your right to have property. But if someone does interfere with your property, you have the right to sue them. So think of what would happen if someone took your phone or someone was to take your car. You could take them to court, you could sue them. And in some instances, if you filed claims with the police, they could be arrested and they could be punished under the criminal code as well as the civil code. So the Brits, when they find out that their property is being destroyed, they're outraged. They argued English common law that this was a direct violation of their inherent rights of property because the opium was a good. It was property. And it also violated principles of free trade. Ding. They also warned Lin to stop. To stop the anti-opium crusade. And if he did not, the Brits threatened military action. Going back to the Portuguese when they first arrived in Calicut and they opened fire during the second expedition led by Cabral. The Brits realized that there was no military presence in Canton and all of their ships had cannon on it. So they threatened actually to sail into the harbor and open fire to kill people. Well, here's the thing. Lin was incorruptible. He was ordered by his ruler to do something. Do you think he gave a rat's butt over what the Brits wanted? I wouldn't. So he continued to do his job. He continued to seize and destroy chests of opium. So guess what ended up happening? England would declare war. And when we come back on Thursday, we're going to learn about not one, but two opium wars. Questions? Don't do that. I got a long day. Yawning at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Papers, papers, papers. Papers, papers, papers. You have till the end of the month to get the bonus. The last bonus. If you do early submission, But if you're going to try to do it, make sure you go on profflamanic.com. As I've said multiple times, I'm not going to grade you based on your writing ability. I'm going to grade you on your ability to follow directions. So if you follow the directions, even if you're not a good writer, you'll get a good grade on it. But if you're a strong writer and you don't follow directions, you will fail. So just read the directions. And of course, if you have any questions, let me know. No, I marked you absent 7 times over. I want to break the circle of perfect attendance. I want to end the semester with 0 people with perfect attendance. No, I actually saw you coming across the parking lot. That's when I did it. Bye.